Well, that's an honor. Mr. Rick Hogan, thank you, Roger. The TV event, to my mind, not only of the summer, but of the year so far, and God knows there's a lot of good stuff on TV, but if you do not watch Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, Thursday at 8 o'clock on Channel 11, and there are all these other times they run it. I mean, the television is totally confusing to me. It is the work of a lot of people, but primarily the work of producers Harvey Moshman and Chuck Coppola, who have been on this story for two decades now and have... There's no more to tell. I think you two, and this is a compliment, I think you have done it definitively. Do you?
Oh, no.
Really?
Well, you know, the skill in making a documentary is knowing what to leave out. And the regret is having to do that.
To leave, so you have to leave something.
So, you know, seven daily newspapers, all of these stories, there were tons of just terribly amusing sidebars that we couldn't include. There's a lot more to tell.
And there are more sidebars about June Fujita, who you just mentioned a few minutes ago.
You want to play, you have a clip from the show. Sure. Dan Long, why don't you play that clip of June Fujita, who's one of the most fascinating people in the history of Chicago.
The Eastland rolled over within blocks of seven Chicago daily newspapers, including the Chicago Herald, that published 14 editions, some just 1 hour apart with new developments. Radio would not come to Chicago for another 6 years. That morning, the editor of the Chicago Evening Post couldn't find his only photographer, 26-year-old June Fujita, who'd been at the paper for less than a year.
Calling him at his house, wasn't answering, frantic. Turns out June was already there and immediately started capturing pictures. June Fujita was the first Japanese photojournalist in Chicago, and he had the big heavy camera. Clearly he identified with the victims of the Eastland. I think as immigrants, they shared a common story of coming over looking for something in America. A reporter asked him if he knew anyone who drowned in the disaster. And June replied, "No, I didn't know anyone who drowned, but I knew all of them."
That's very moving, very moving.
He had an empathy for the victims that he was photographing. He felt, if you will, their pain. And I think that that drew him to really continue climbing all over the Eastland. And years later, at the end of his career, when he'd covered all sorts of things, like the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
The race riots.
The race riots in 1919. The only thing he kept an album of, a keepsake, if you will, of that day, of his news career, was an album of photographs of the Eastland.
Mm.
And he wrote also, you know, notes of what he thought about this. And he thought of what avail is, you know, pity in the face of human carelessness. He had his own thoughts about why this happened.
It was, on the level of human carelessness, something out of almost like The Great Gatsby, about the carelessness of the rich. The fact that the two owners of the boat, who had no business, to my mind, or to your mind, as you did, even owning a boat, you know, the boat becomes, to my mind, kind of even a tragic figure, not to anthropomorphize, but becomes a kind of tragic figure in this whole thing.
I would say certainly that anybody who thinks of themselves as a maritime person always wants to find the hero in the ship. And in our documentary, the Eastland does redeem herself. She is reincarnated. I won't give it away just yet.
Right.
But, you know, you want to see the ship maintained well. You want to see it in trim and in ship shape. And these two owners in particular ran her into the ground.
Yeah. It was called at one point the Greyhound of the Great Lakes because it was a speedy boat. Then it was called, and this is a haunting one to me, the Blue Collar Titanic, because the Titanic had gone down 2 years before. And this was a blue-collar crowd of 844 people, including many, many, many children and many, many, many women who died. They were mostly factory workers.
Right. I mean, you asked earlier what drew us to this story initially.
Yeah.
And I believe that in 2001, when we were first planning on doing this, there was just so few people who knew anything about this in the first place. And I'll have to tell you my Channel 11 story. So my boss walks in and says, every producer has to pick a topic for Chicago Stories, our new series. And I waited a day and I said, okay, I want to do the Eastland disaster. And the reply was, what's that?
What's that?
So I knew this was going to be a great story. And at that time...
And you also knew it, like everything at Channel 11, without naming names, it's going to be a hard sell.
Andy White from Looking Glass Theater, who ultimately went on to make a play
about
the Eastland, his inciting incident was that 9 out of 10 people he talked to had never heard of it. And I believe he took a poll standing down at the river and Clark Street asking people if they knew what happened here. And,
do you know what this plaque is about? Yeah. Do you know what this plaque
And that plaque took 50-something years to get there.
Sure.
And if it wasn't for the kids at the Illinois Math and Science Academy in Aurora... as a school project, that plaque would never have been there. And the city, to this day, still a mystery to me, why this isn't recognized. Fort Dearborn Massacre is, of course, in the fire.
Yeah.
It's not a glamorous story on the face of it. A steamship, not particularly large, not particularly great like the Titanic, rolls over in a muddy river.
Yeah.
And the people who are killed are... first-generation immigrants or factory workers.
Many of whom do not know how to speak English.
It's not John Jacob Astor.
Yep.
You know, it's not.
And the ship has not gone anywhere. I think that's an element of it, too.
Right.
If it had been out in the middle of the lake, I think for some reason, I'm not an expert in tragedies, it becomes a bigger tragedy. Or if they had been coming back from the picnic in Michigan City and it had gone down, who knows?
It clearly looked like someone did something wrong.
Yeah.
And someone should have paid.
Well, it did. And someone, you know, the memory of the survivors, I said they were probably haunted by what happened that day because they were blamed. I mean, the narrative was, well, these people, it was raining and the too many crowded in and then they moved to one side and they tipped the boat over. That, as you will learn in Eastland, Chicago's deadliest day, is not the case. Those people were not to blame. They were the victims. And the people who were to blame, having, you know, orchestrated to get the trial moved and moved and moved again and then hire Clarence Darrow to defend you, that's what bothers me about that whole...
Well, the rumor was that the passengers all went to one side.
Right.
And that's what caused the tip. Yeah. It was started by... the company, the owners of the boat.
Of course.
Because they wanted to lay the blame on the passengers. That turned out not to be true. And there were accounts in the newspaper 2 days later that they were packed on too closely to budge. They couldn't have actually moved all to one side.
But the weight of the cement blocks and the so-called boats, the lifeboats up on top, did them in. You guys, I my admiration for both of you, I know you a lot better, Harvey, for more years, but Chuck, I know your work too, and my admiration for both of you was extraordinarily high before this. And when Harvey said, well, we got a new movie, I go, oh, good, let's see. And I cannot tell you, how do you two, what is the, not to bore people in the last few minutes of the show, what is the collaborative process? I mean, in writing and producing, you guys obviously know one another very well and respect one another very well and are onto a topic that you both have your heart and soul into. What's the collaborative process?
Well, Chuck did the heavy lifting on the script. He would write the first drafts, and then I would chime in. And if it wasn't for Google Docs, because Chuck lives in California, I live here, that would have been a much more difficult process. And then since I was here, I did the bulk of the producing and getting things done. And, we also went to Canada
to shoot
on the Kiwan.
There are some recreations in here. I think that's a bold – I mean, that's always, to me, in any documentary, a bold move. I mean, it is one that has to be done with a lot of care to not look.
We were very careful not to overstep the recreations.
Yeah.
So we knew though that we didn't have any pictures of anyone boarding the vessel. Nobody bothered to take a picture.
Or any real, you know, interiors of the boat,
right,
except for the most horrific images. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing. And I just wanted to finish up on the process here.
Sure.
Writing. I write overnight, and so I start at midnight and I go till 4 a.m. And sometimes you get these epiphanies at 3:30 in the morning when you've been reading fact after fact after fact. And then you get this crystallization of you know, of funerals and the collective sense of loss, and it just came to me, Chicago felt empty. I wasn't here in 1915, but after reading everything and culling through all this research, it sure felt to me as though the city must have felt desolate.
Well, 700 funerals on one day and a casket shortage will give you that sense. Fellas, I don't know what to tell you. I said it, a lot of it in print today in the Tribune. You can read the story.
There's a couple of surprising things I can throw at you really quickly.
Sure.
One of them, petty crime. Nobody anticipated, neither one of us anticipated, the level of petty crime that was associated with the pickpockets.
Oh, when all the dead bodies. Well, and also,
the newspapers called them ghouls.
Yeah.
Well, they were on infiltrated not only Dockside, but the armory and the homes where the wakes were held, private homes, brazenly approaching the victims' bodies, taking valuables from the house.
Well, the other disgusting thing, too, just human curiosity, are the building owners that would charge 5 cents or 10 cents, and the people who would pay the 5 cents and 10 cents to go up to the roof to watch, you know, the human frog and other people trying to save bodies. It cannot, you know. I know you have.
Well, that's an entrepreneurial spirit. I applaud that. I mean, but you know, somebody who can make a dime off a tragedy, yeah. Go for it. This
Go
is Chicago.
You guys, that is the, you're getting a sense of these two grand talents, and that's the film. It is, even though it concerns one of the great tragedies in the history of this country, wildly entertaining. Congratulations, fellas. There's no telling where this, I know awards are nice, and if they come with checks, they're even nicer, but it's a great movie. The Eastland, Chicago's Deadliest Day, premieres, a real kind of world premiere, except for a couple private showings. World premiere, 8 p.m. Thursday on Channel 11, wherever you find that. Chuck, Harvey, congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a couple minutes.
All right.
That's the music of Steve Goodman from a new release, Affordable Art. He's been gone a long time. Now, for the third time on this show, because they have a third book out, it is my great pleasure to welcome in Bob Carr and Dirk Johnson. Dirk and I were colleagues in the crazy newspaper business, and he has proved himself then at the Sun-Times and at the New York Times to be one of the most talented reporters, and especially writers. That's often a weird combination. You don't often get them together, only occasionally. He and Bob have... How did you two meet? Hi, Bob. Good to see you. Hi,
see
Dirk.
You,
good to see you.
Thanks for those
Remind
comments.
Me. Oh, no, you're my constant. If you publish a book, and they're always interesting, you're booked on the show. Remind me how the two of you met, will you, Dirk?
It was through a mutual friend who was doing some work for Bob, Michael McMillan, and we had a cup of coffee at the airport and talked about life in general and some of our past mishaps, and hit it off, and it's been a great collaboration.
Bob, you have had one of the most, and Dirk, I'm sure you'll admit this too, one of the most interesting lives. seriously, from your, you know, sort of not impoverished youth, but a youth, and this goes to the point of your latest book too, where you needed a helping hand. Yes?
Yes.
What was wrong in your youth?
Just having a parent in the house that was very destructive to his six children. And a mother who was at the opposite end of that spectrum. It was very confusing to grow up in a house with two bedrooms and nine people living in the house. It was with a father who was just not there for you, and when he was, you wish he wasn't.
Yeah. How did you wind up being saved? You were smart. Let's start with that. You were a smart kid.
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. I always knew there was something wrong, And when I got out of the house at the age of 17, you know, things all came together fairly quickly about what happened. And I was just able to figure it out better than my siblings, frankly.
But you needed help. And that was sort of the nature of the first book on which you collaborated.
My seventh grade teacher, I think this is really the point I should have made.
Yeah, I do too.
My seventh grade teacher had been a double-A professional baseball player. I was a great White Sox fan back in the late 50s. And he became a school teacher and was my seventh grade homeroom teacher and social studies teacher. And he talked about there being another world out there.
Yeah.
And he set the pace. And that's what we're all about, is mentoring these young people. And that's where I learned that from, and I'm not sure where Dirk learned his from, but I'm sure he did from someone.
Well, but in first hearing this story, Dirk, and putting it down on paper in your first book, Through the Fires, there's a $250 loan, if my memory serves.
A scholarship. Bob was a senior in high school.
Yeah.
And much to his surprise, he was awarded a $250 scholarship by the local women's club. As a kid, Bob didn't even know there was a women's club in town. And he said that it made him feel so good and recognized that he vowed that if I ever have extra money, I'm going to reach out to help kids that have come from circumstances like mine. And it took some decades, and Bob hit it very big.
I never understood. You know, I certainly admire success on any level, but I never understood what Bob did. You know what I mean? It's a you know, financial kind of, what is it? What was it?
Payment processing.
Part of it was being in the right place at the right time. I suspect you may remember the old credit card slips, back the paper slips, when you would buy something with your credit card
at a
store.
Far too well, Bob. Far too well.
Exactly. Well, I was right there at the right time when that paper transaction was converting to an electronic transaction. And so my company became the fifth largest payment processor in America, which is just hard to believe.
Well, it's an amazing... Well, it's one of those businesses that you think, wait a minute, why do you need this business? But you became incredibly successful. The great point of it is, and what Dirk must have really appealed to you, is that altruistic nature, that whole notion that someone did something for you. This women's club basically gave you $250, and you said, that's unbelievable. It empowered you in a lot of ways, and you said to yourself, if I ever make it, I'm going to give back. I would hazard to say, Dirk, and we're cynical newsmen, that for every 10,000 people who said that at some point,
right,
none except this guy followed
right,
through.
Right, right.
Is that,
and all those years later.
Yeah.
One of the things that is most striking when you're around Bob is that he really has very little care about material things. I don't think you much care. Bob doesn't much care what kind of car he drives. The idea of having a private jet strikes him as ridiculous. But when he's in a room with kids that have come through difficult circumstances, they really, really connect. He is not just another rich guy.
Or another do-gooder.
That's right.
I do have to say, there are other business people, men and women, who are generous with their funds and so on. I don't think it's 1 out of 10,000, but it might be.
I think it's one out of ten thousand. And I think, you know, okay, the Bill and Melinda Gates, I'm sure they do a lot of good things with their money, but you're my 1 out of 10,000. What, when you decided, were you doing things all along, Bob, during your career, or did it happen after? And I think there's a very important thing to sit down with someone like Dirk and share your life and have it on paper. That's empowering, too. Was that the motivating force for starting all the other things you've started?
You know, I was one of these guys who worked for 25 years and then was an overnight success.
Yeah, right, sure.
And so, sure. You know, I had to make a decision one day of what to do with a lot more money than I ever could imagine ever needing. And it was, I tried doing a couple of things. I built Lockport, Illinois, is where I'm from, and we built a park in downtown Lockport, and that was a several million dollar project. It changed the town. I loved doing that. I'm very interested in history. I was able to buy Woodrow Wilson's house and been involved in other historical things. I was in the city council in Lockport for a while. And but having all this money just really was an overnight thing, and I hadn't thought a heck of a lot about it, except that I did want to give back to the Women's Club. And that's how it started, by giving them a check for $5,000 to pay them back for my $250.
Did they know who you were? Did they have a record of having given you the $250 at some point?
Well, they do now, because
I'll bet they do now. Yeah, but I'm sure they do now. That's a nice thing to do. But when trying to figure out what to do, there are a lot of places that need financial help.
Amen.
And you started something on your own. You didn't say, well, maybe I could give to some, youth basketball program or a youth baseball program or the White Sox Junior All-Stars program or something. How did you conceptualize what became your sort of...
Well, this is where I think my growing up situation, really put it into perspective for me, because I knew how valuable it was to get an education. And by starting off giving other high school kids scholarship funds like I received back in 63, it became almost an immediate attraction to these kids, because they finally had somebody that recognized them. And we've been doing this now thousands of times throughout the country over these last 10, 15 years. And our model, our program works, and it works because I think I have a deep appreciation for what many of these kids have gone through.
Well, especially with your third book. We got to take a commercial break. See, I'm so into you, I blew the commercial by like 3 minutes. We'll be back with Bob Carr and Dirk Johnson to talk about not only their second book, but their third book. And I will tell you an anecdote about something I saw on TV tonight that is so germane on 60 Minutes to what this book is about and what you're doing. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. 10:32, and here with the news, sorry, Roger Badish. Well, thank you, Mr. Roger Badish. My great old friend and colleague, Dirk Johnson, and I like to consider him a new friend, Bob Carr, have collaborated on three books so far. Through the Fires, An American Story of Turbulence, Business Triumph, and Giving Back, which is basically Bob's biography, sort of as with Dirk's help, and Dirk is a very talented writer. The second was Working Class to College, The Promise and Peril Facing Blue-Collar America, which was a very provocative book. In the midst of this, Bob started what is now a public charity called Give Something Back, which is meant to pay the college, in essence, to pay college tuition for kids who can't afford it. I will tell you tonight, mostly kids whose parents have been incarcerated or who are homeless, and the numbers for that, Dirk, I was stunned.
Yeah, or foster kids. Yeah.
Or foster kids. Tell me some of the numbers. They're really stunning and chilling at the same time.
There are 2.7 million kids in the United States that have experienced parental incarceration. On any given day, there are roughly 500,000 kids in foster care. And then there are many that are uncounted, that are in some sort of informal situation, but don't have a permanent home.
Well, we hear about some of these frighteningly and with some frequency on, when there's a crisis, when one of the kids dies or something. On 60 Minutes tonight, and I just want to bring this up because it goes to some of the stories that you told. The last book is First Chance, How Kids with Nothing Can Change Everything, and it's about 2 years of you, Dirk, going around and talking to children who are benefiting from...
Both Bob and I, yeah.
You went together, that's great. It must have been at some points... I'll get into specifics, but today on 60 Minutes, they had a story about a kid from Nebraska named Sean, S-H-O-N, Hapwood, who, was a screw-up in school. He drank himself out of 1 year of a basketball scholarship somewhere. He then drank himself out of a couple years in the Navy. He then got hooked up with a guy who thought it would be a good idea to rob little banks because they wouldn't get caught. Mm. He got convicted and thrown in prison for, I think, 20 years. In his time in prison, he became a kind of a clerk in the library, started reading law books, literally wrote a brief, submitted to help another convict, and then went all the way to the Supreme Court. And so that wound up attracting a lot of attention. He eventually, through some really good mentors and people helping him, was able to become an attorney. He's now a professor at Georgetown University.
What a story.
It's a great story. But you found stories not dissimilar as you two went out to see, hey, how's this? Basically, it was to see how everything was going, wasn't it?
There was, as an example, a kid named Ricardo Dale was severely abused by a babysitter and ran away from home, was homeless. when he came to the attention of Give Something Back, and he got a scholarship through the program, and he has now been elected to the board of trustees on the college as a student representative, as a senior. It was just remarkable for somebody that had been through the travails that he had.
See, what both of you gentlemen seem to have, and you put your money where your mouth is, Bob Carr, is an unrelenting faith in humanity. I don't mean to make much of it. I really mean that. I mean, you have a of the faith and the resilience of the human spirit that no matter how much someone is beaten up, and some of these kids have been beaten up beyond all reason, that with help, they can triumph. I mean, you do believe that, right, Bob?
I believe to my core that by going through these very painful upbringings, that kids who get something, just a little bit of help, they grab onto it, and their receptacles of all the information they can get. And the subtitle of our book about kids who are lost can do anything. We have example after example after example of that. And I just think the nature of going through all this pain and trouble creates a person, when they realize they can break through all that, that they have a way to get through it. It empowers them to help others and to do what I've been trying to do, you know, with my career. And I really think that some of these kids, like Ricardo, is a perfect example. Though we have many, many others. These kids become the leaders. I've given 3 graduation speeches where the student speaker, selected by the students in the college, were our kids.
Wow.
These kids become leaders. It's really a very exciting thing. And one of the problems we try to focus on is, let's stop setting low standards. Let's raise the bar. You kids can get A's and B's. You have to get a B average minimum to be in our program.
How does one apply to the program?
Usually it's a high school counselor that knows the kind of
situations,
and we want kids who have gone through, we want the kids who've gone through the worst of times, and they just have a little bit of spark of determination, and we give them some tools, and it turns them around very quickly. We picked 222 kids for our scholarships 3 years ago in 2016. Of those 222 kids, which are mostly homeless and children of incarcerated parents, 100% of those kids graduated high school, and 215
out of 222
are going to college in the fall, 97%. And these are all kids that could have been written off in ninth grade, and we gave them a scholarship.
Well, there are kids who were written off in ninth grade, but for you and the foundation, which is now a public charitable foundation, Give Something Back. I'm assuming it's givesomethingback.org.
It's actually Give Something Back, a New Jersey nonprofit.
Oh, okay. Well, you know.
To be technical, but we had trademark
issues.
No,
you should be technical about it. You should be technical. Some of the stories that you encounter have got to be, for both of you, initially heartbreaking. Because we now live in an era when prisons are warehouses. And some of the kids and some of the parents, probably, you must say to yourself, wait a minute, this parent doesn't belong in jail.
So much of the time. Almost all of the problems that led to imprisonment are rooted in addiction, particularly with the mothers.
Yeah.
And the prisons have become the mental health providers in as much as they provide treatment.
As much treatment. As they can. Right. Yeah.
But there are many prisons that are actually former mental health hospitals. Logan Women's Prison in Lincoln, Illinois, is an example.
We got to take one quick last break, and then we'll carry on with these gentlemen all the way to the end of the show. You really do, ladies and gentlemen, need to get all three books. I mean, I would really, really recommend Through the Fires to be followed by Working Class to College to be followed by the latest book, First Chance. I mean, you need to read about your story, and then you need to read about your activism, and then you need to read, as you do in First Class, about this activism in action, what it is doing, what it is meaning. Now, get a pencil. I'm going to give you two websites. The first is giveback.ngo, right?
Yes.
Thank you, Bob. The other, where you can get these three books, because I think these books should be read as a kind of trilogy, though I know there will be another one because I need you back on this radio show, is Robert O. Carr. That's RobertOCarr.com. That's how you can get all three books. People obviously listening, Bob, want to know what they might be able to do. What can they do on their own? I mean, I think some people want to help, but don't know how.
Well, for every $20,000 that we receive, we can put one kid through college.
Is that right?
Which is a great bargain, and that's one of the motivations for us doing what we're doing. But there's five things that a person can do. I mean, at different levels. They can adopt a child. And lots of folks do that, and it's such a wonderful thing all around. Secondly, they can become a foster parent. We need more good foster parents in this country.
Good being the operative word.
Absolutely.
Here. And we need more good people at the Department of Children and Family Services, too.
We certainly do. Next, they can become a CASA. A CASA is a court-appointed special advocate. Every county in America virtually is connected to a CASA chapter. And we've been encouraging this, and we have been able to get many, many people to look into CASA. By being a CASA, it's a volunteer position, but the CASA is the representative of a child. And a child goes into court, and the parents are fighting with each other, and nobody's looking out for the child. And the CASA, that's their job. And it's such a tremendous program.
Oh, so rewarding.
And there are hundreds of thousands of kids going through this issues with the court, and they don't have an advocate. So that's a desperate need for that all across the country. If you don't have time to be a CASA, be a mentor. Get involved with there's many mentoring organizations around the country. We have them in seven states ourselves. And the other thing is the children that we work with, we pick ninth graders primarily, but if these kids can get some help in middle school or even more elementary school, reach out and work with other nonprofits and help get these kids the mentoring that they need. So those are the things that people can do to help a lot.
Dirk Johnson, working with this man must have changed your life in a number of ways.
In a lot of ways, yes. It's I have, as anybody who knows me has heard, I have the deepest admiration for Bob and for what he's chosen to do with his time and his wealth, and it's not, I think, what almost any other person would do to continue to work that hard at it.
And when you see, you know, being on the front lines, especially with the latest book, First Chance, all of these books again published by University of Illinois Press, going out and interviewing these young people who are benefiting from this, that it's got to be terribly emotional for you, because you're getting and you got out of them in this really good, very sort of introspective stories. That's a hard thing to do with young people sometimes.
Well, absolutely. First of all, they're young. They're living in chaos, so that to make an appointment with somebody for a week from Tuesday for kids that don't know what their life is going to look like that afternoon is very, very difficult. And then they open up. I give credit to the kids who were willing to speak on the record with their names.
And trust, there's a level of trust that they have to develop. You two are, as I can attest, both very likable guys, but I haven't told you my inner secrets yet, but right. You do. What you get from these kids, there's a real level of honesty to these stories they tell.
And their parents as well.
That's true, exactly. Yeah.
Who have... one of the main figures in the book, Mercedes Marquez, mother Angie, has struggled all her life with heroin, and she sat there with a plastic crucifix around her neck, and said, "People say I'd never stick a needle in my arm. People say I'd never steal. People say I'd never stand on a corner and sell myself. All my nevers came true." Mm. This is not a bad person.
Yeah,
and that was the case so often. That these were families that were just struggling terribly.
Well, what comes through in many of these stories, and you can address this too, Bob, is that human beings are incredibly fragile.
They are very fragile, but they also can be very resilient.
No question.
And what we try to do is give them the tools to help them to become resilient. Motivation is much more important to the success of a student in school than their innate ability. We all know PhDs who are, working for Uber. Not that that's a bad job,
right?
But it's certainly overeducated. So by giving the kid, the student, the tools that they need to deal with it, I think, and giving them the hope of a college education. When we started the program, we gave money just like everybody else did.
Well, because that seems always, if you got it, the easiest thing to do.
And it is the easiest thing, and it was great. The kids are great. Some of them are some of my best friends to this day. But then we realized, these kids are seniors in high school. It's too late. Let's go down into 8th grade, 7th grade, 6th grade, and pick kids then. That program worked really well. So we went from giving money to giving mentoring. Then we went to giving hope. And that's why we're telling these kids in junior high and ninth grade, you're going to go to college if you get a B average. And we only had 7 kids out of 222 that didn't get a B average. And this is
amazing
out of a high school, one of the poorest high schools in the state of New Jersey.
There's that old, what you two are doing is, to borrow a phrase from Ernest Hemingway, you're making people, you're helping them become strong at the broken places. Hmm. That's a phrase of Hemingway's. And a lot of these people are broken through really no fault of their own, the fragility of human nature. But what you're doing is you're making them strong at those places.
And these kids become leaders for the other kids in the program, and they gain strength from one another. It's palpable to be with these kids in a group.
What's your next book, fellas? When can I book you? 2 years from now? Bob, I just have to say congratulations. You're getting married a week from Saturday to this beautiful woman sitting in the studio.
Guy.
You're a lucky guy in a lot of ways.
That's for sure.
I think, Dirk, you are too, to have hooked up in this. I mean, I keep telling you to go to Robert O. Carr, the website, to buy this trilogy, which I'm calling the Carr-Johnson trilogy. Because your life is fascinating, your ideas about college education, which you could, if you could, would transform. You'd transform completely, and it's very, very topical. Given how, college screws, frankly, kids from who don't have the means to go. And it's a rigged system.
It's very unfortunate. Yeah. There's 45 million kids in this country, not kids, people, who have started college and dropped out.
Yeah.
And now they've got to pay off, most of them, student loans with minimum wage.
It's horrible. And you've seen in recent headlines the way people try to game that system. But and then you can finish your reading this summer, your summer reading with First Chance, which is just a book about small all because of you guys, but small triumphs over tragedies, near tragedies, and messed up lives.
Yes, it's remarkable to see what these young people have achieved.
Well, and you do it. I mean, you develop both of your level of trust with these kids and their parents to tell these stories with power. It's an ongoing, I've known you for a really long time, but it's an ongoing pleasure to know your new bride, and to keep reading you. I hope there's a fourth. We can have a quartet.
You bet, Rick. Thank you,
right, you guys.
Thank
keep
you
up
so
the
much,
great work. Oh, no, my pleasure. Dirk Johnson and Bob Carr. Go to robertocarr.com to buy the books. Thank you very much for listening. Dan Long, you're the world's greatest engineer. Ro Coleman, you're the world's greatest producer. Did you say yes, thank you, or what did you say? Nah, no, I'm not. Coming up is Carl Amari and his fabulous show.